The lights are on red. We're away.
Oh, and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, April 10th, 2009, and this is episode number 172. I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today to bring you all kinds of stuff about MotoGP, and of course a little bit about World Superbike too. Big weekend coming up, because this is the opening round of the 2009 MotoGP season there in Qatar. As you listen to this show, the weekend is actually occurring. The race is coming up here on Sunday. Hope you're going to get a chance to watch that. Of course, Jules and I are doing a call here that we're going to have here in the show in just a little bit, talking about the MotoGP, sort of a season review, kind of what's going to happen to Qatar, these sort of things. And also we do talk a little bit about the World Superbike round that we just had last weekend at Valencia. So a fairly long call. We're going to get to that pretty quickly. I got a couple of administrative notes I want to run through here real quick and some news and an explanation. First of all, big shout out, thank you to Leon McDonald. Leon was kind enough to donate to the MotoGPOD cause and really, really appreciate that. Thanks a lot, Leon. Always good to have some help with the bandwidth bills and all that. I actually got a bill from him a while ago. It's I normally keep a big balance on the account there, and it's like, wow, they need more money. So appreciate that. Thanks a lot, Leon. Then I've got a bit of bad news, and first tip that I got on this one was from listener Paul Krizik. Sent me a story, a link to an Australian newspaper, The Age, and motorcyclist Judd Greedy was killed at the Australian Superbike Championship in Tasmania on April 5th. Judd Greedy was 28 years old, died after losing control of his motorcycle while leading the race at Simmons Plains. Two riders in the middle of the pack were unable to avoid Greedy and his fallen bike, one of the bikes exploding in a fireball as its fuel tank ignited upon impact. Greedy was treated by medical personnel but died at the scene. So that's tragic. We always hate to hear that when our when the racers that we come out to watch that we enjoy so much watching and they face these dangers and everything, and every now and then this does happen. So it's a big tragedy, and condolences go out to Judd's family and friends and everything else, and it really is a shame. Moving on. Another thing that Paul mentioned in his email was he brought my attention to a rule change that prevents rookie factory riders. And this is dated Saturday, 28th of March, reading this off Crash.net. The story was MotoGP rookies will be banned from riding for a factory team as part of new rule changes to be introduced for 2010. A rule forcing all rookies to spend at least one season on a satellite team. Which is kind of interesting. This rule is intended to help support the satellite outfits and will provide manufacturers with further incentive to back at least one independent team in addition to their official outfit. These are just more rules that Dorna is trying to come up with to keep the grid as full as possible, which is good for the sport. Mixed feelings about all these rules. Jules and I talk about this quite a bit too in our call, so we'll get to that. Speaking of rule changes, and this was one that we did not cover all that well in the call, and Jules mentioned it and said, hey, you know, why don't you talk about this in the intro? So I'm gonna. This one is one of the changes that's taking place for this year, for 2009, and it governs the practice sessions. Basically, for MotoGP class only, at the start of the warm-up, apparently, okay, so this is not all practice sessions. The headline says practice sessions warm-up inclusive, which I took to mean all practice sessions, but the text says at the start of the warm-up, so it's presumably only during the warm-up. Following procedure will apply. Pit lane exit opens for 2 minutes. Countdown board of 2 minute, 1 minute, 30 seconds shown at the pit lane exit. At the end of that 2 minutes, the pit lane exit closes. Riders who are still in pit lane at that time will not be allowed to practice start. The riders that are on the track complete one lap without stopping and go onto the starting grid. They stop on the starting grid, practice start, and complete one lap without stopping and enter the pit lane. As soon as the last rider has completed his lap, pit lane exit opens to continue the warm-up. So they're sort of formalizing the practice start, at least at the beginning of the morning warm-up, probably to kind of increase entertainment value of the warm-up, if you will. That 20-minute warm-up in the morning is always, you know, they do like to get their practice starts in and stuff, and typically they've always done it at the end of it, and there's been rule changes about that. MotoGP riders are no longer allowed to do practice starts at the end of the qualifying session, which actually did make a lot of sense. And they so now they're just sort of creating this one at the beginning of the warm-up, which will almost, in some ways, from the sound of it, it'll be somewhat of a spectacle, because at least for those folks, they can see the starting grid, because you're going to see a whole bunch of practice starts. It doesn't sound like it's – yeah, it's not going to be like a – it'll just be that like practice starts were, I'm sure, where it's, you know, a rider or two goes off at a time. It's not like, you know, a flag drops and everybody takes off all at once. So there's the practice start rule clarified. And let's see. I think that about covers the stuff that I wanted to talk about in the beginning of the show. We got a long call with Jules. So why don't we go ahead and get into that, and I'll come back for the outro. All right. We got Jules on the phone. How you doing today, Jules?
Hey, I'm doing fine. How are you, Bob?
Doing very well. Thank you. It's a beautiful day up here in Oregon. Getting excited about MotoGP this weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so finally, long wait is over. We're going to have a season starting here. But we had World Supers last weekend, which was pretty good stuff down there in Valencia.
For Valencia, it definitely was good racing.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, World Superbikes first then. This is their third round there in Valencia, first round in Europe. A lot of talk because Ben Spies has been doing spectacularly well. If you're not following World Superbikes, you should. And hit the first two rounds there, Spies won, what, 3 out of 4, correct? He crashed out of the very, very first race. And
well, he didn't crash out. He just
didn't
got
crash out. He
actually got points from it.
Right. But did not, you know, he crashed or went off track to which relegated him down farther down the standings. And so Haga won that first one. Then Spies picked up 3 in a row. And everybody was like, oh, Ben Spies, you've come to save World Superbike.
Not only that, but he's also been on pole every single time, including Valencia.
Exactly. And he's doing spectacularly well. He really is. And it's an impressive performance.
We did say that this is a very, very important 3 races for him. If he can kick, you know, the kind of butt that he's been kicking in these 3 rounds, then I think he's going to be unstoppable. But as it turned out, that, you know, he's not indestructible. He's not
not infallible.
Not infallible. Yeah, not infallible. That's a better.
Yeah,
word.
Yeah, I agree. He
infallible, I should say.
Infallible. Yes, because as you said, he started on pole, but didn't race one. Didn't get a too spectacular start, and unfortunately, crashed out pretty quick. But Haga. You know, this is Haga's year, I think. Haga's got to do it this year, and now he's got Ben Spies nipping at his heels, which is you know, going to be making things a little bit difficult for him.
Yeah, you know, it's crazy because he has to balance, you know, consistency, which is not his forte, with what actually makes him a great racer, which is this kind of nutty approach to racing. I mean, he still, when Neukirchner was running away in the first race and Haga caught him for a couple of laps there, I mean, he did that Haga, you know, sitting directly on Neukirchner's rear tire for like a couple of laps. I mean, it's just unbelievable how he can hang in there. He loves being that really, really that close. He just then just pounced. He just got the braking just right after the straight. It wasn't a power run because Suzuki could outpower the duck over that length. And it was just a braking. He just got it right finally and was able to pass Neukirchner, and then he got away. But, you know, that kind of riding, if Neukirchner made one mistake, they would have been both out of it. So there's this balance that he has to win these races because he knows there's a lot of talent out there. I mean, it's really already becoming a Ben Spies Haga battle. Point wise, but this kind of a advantage that he has right now, it's in World Superbikes, two races every round. I mean, you can rack up points very quickly, and you know, he has to get that consistency up, which he's not well known for. This is the best start he's had since he had a full year in Superbikes.
I actually was kind of impressed with the Brazilian race 2. His is non-Hagenist. Just have how he is. He's out there. He's pushing really, really hard. But there doesn't seem to be any of that sort of almost win it or bin it kind of thing that he used to have going on.
He's very smooth. I think he knows. Yeah. He knows what he needs to do, and he also was watching how Bayless did it last year. You know, those couple of offs that Bayless had were there were exceptions in the general. It was very smooth riding up front, and we were watching battles for second a lot of the time. You know,
right?
Which is
right.
Kind of what happened in race two. You know, actually battle for third.
Exactly, in race two, battle for third, battle for sixth. There was a lot of exciting battles in race two. And it was a little confusing almost to watch the race on the coverage because they kept flicking back and forth between these various, you know, exciting battles that were going on.
And in the second race with the Laconia and Fabrizio, I mean, Fabrizio, I think, could have caught Spies, actually, with a few more laps. I don't think this is necessarily a Spies issue. I think that the bike was just not set for this track. Valencia is a tricky track to set up for because it's got that one straight and then that crazy, you know, I mean, it's got some slow sections and it's got that back straight, which is kinks just as you're, I think, probably going through fourth, and then you have to immediately hit the brakes, and then that crazy back corner where you're just slowing down until you're like, you know, second gear, 40 miles an hour, hitting the straight again.
Right, and going downhill as well.
And it's an amazingly difficult corner, that last one. And actually, we only lost. I don't think we really lost anyone there. It was the first corner that Spies went off in first race. That was kind of surprising.
Yeah, I think if I recall, or several instances at least, where at the first corner, there was a lot of casualties out of the first race.
Well, I know Ray crashed. Corsa crashed out of like fourth. That was a real shame, actually. That was a real bummer to see Corsa.
In race one, he got he got such a great start. I mean,
he was running in fourth, and he was actually looking pretty strong. This is a good track for a underpowered bike to actually, you know, have a good finish
that far up. But even, you know, fourth is amazing. I mean, you know, BMW new motorcycle and all of that kind of stuff. But if anybody can do it, it's going to be Corsa. But it was impressive. Both Czechas crashed out of race one. Carlos David. Yes. So, race one, good stuff. Haga ended up winning it. I'm always happy to see that. Fabrizio, his teammate, took second. So that's Ducati 1-2. That's, real good stuff. Neukirchner, who is somewhat our man to be inconsistent in World Superbikes, we've often noticed, but it did a very good performance there.
He's always like this track. I mean, he almost won it last year, one of the races, and that Checa took him out in the last corner, last lap.
He did well all weekend overall. But yeah, as far as the whole season is concerned, Neukirchner's a bit of a
he disappears in the mid pack a lot. Definitely. Yeah. Let me ask you something and be honest.
Uh oh. Okay.
Okay. When you saw that Yamaha in the dirt, were you hoping it was Spies in race one?
Only because I want Haga to win. there was a little bit of that, yeah.
Because they showed it and they didn't quite say it yet, and it was like, and I mean, I feel so bad, but I was like, God, I hope that's Spies. It's terrible. It's terrible.
Well, the guy, terrible. I don't know. There's just something not right when, you know, he comes to Superbikes, World Superbikes, and it's his first year. So he's officially a World Superbike rookie, you know, even though he's been in AMA for years and he's an accomplished racer. He can't come in here and spank Haga, who's been working at this for years and years and years. You know? that's just not okay.
I really did. I was just like, maybe Spies. Oh, it's Spies. Yes. And then I felt, oh, poor Spies. Oh, that sucks. Oh,
that really is awful. Go, baby. Yeah, I know. I kind of had the same sort of feeling of like, you know, oh, wow. There's hope for Haga at this race.
Right.
Because, it didn't look initially all that great for Haga at that point. Max Biaggi finished eighth. He's the other guy that I'm kind of watching in World Supers. Mm-hmm. And we should mention John Hopkins. His race won was and actually that was confusing me earlier on because I was for some reason or another getting their numbers confused. Both Spies and Hopkins are using different numbers than I'm accustomed to.
Well, Spies, because 21
they can't
was
use their regular numbers, right? Numbers, yeah, exactly. So. And so you know, it just haven't quite got used to that. That Hopkins is running 121, and Spies is running 19.
Right.
So that's screwing me up. In any case, though, Hopkins had actually, race one, there wasn't a whole lot of coverage of him that I recall.
They did show him a couple of times, but nothing exciting.
More as a novelty and stuff. I don't remember a lot of, you know, close battles or anything like that on the coverage. It was, that one was pretty much the, an upfront show. And what did Hawke ended up finishing that? He beat Fabrizio by what, 3.6 seconds, almost 3.7.
He won both races handily. It was the battles behind him that were really the closer ones because he really did have a good setup and good feel, good rhythm. Once he got front and once Spies crashed and he knew that Spies wasn't coming for him, I'm sure he relaxed a little bit. And just
but he didn't relax too much.
No, he didn't.
No.
He was actually he set the record lap that I believe it was like the record was set in 2003 in World Superbikes at Valencia, and he beat it during that first race. So that's
right,
a pretty
lap
big
record.
Thing. That's a
the
long
old lap record.
Record.
2003, Neil Hodgson. Wow.
Yeah.
And that was the. The previous and the best lap Ben Spies had picked up in qualifying or practice at some time or another with a pretty handy time. But that's another record that went down because Haga picked that up. Race two, I was a little concerned because Haga didn't get a very good start. He ended up finishing the first lap down in third, but I know he was meandering down around in fourth or fifth for portions of that lap.
That's what I was kind of like leading up to with the, he has to balance the consistency, but he still has to be Haga because it's this samurai slide that wins all those races when he actually ends up staying on the bike.
Yeah.
He shoved it in there a couple of times, the old Haga was there. But once he got past, and once he had a little bit of clear space, even when he was chasing the next guy up, he was very, very smooth, much smoother than I'm used to seeing. Although his lines are still very different, and
yeah.
there was actually some talk on the Eurosport feed that one of the journos that covers that took a ride on Haga's Yamaha. Last year, and was just flabbergasted by how front end oriented the bike is, and how it turns on a dime, but how incredibly scary it is to ride a Haga bike. So Haga definitely puts a lot of trust in his front, and he can do, and he rides a different line because of that, because the geometry of the machine is quite different from the other riders.
Interesting. So, I didn't realize it was quite that different. I know that he has been always very picky. We've talked about the incident with the forks when he was riding the R1 several years ago, and they had to actually pull the forks off of the old R7.
That's right.
It was in the museum. I love that story. That's awesome.
Yeah.
It's like, I need my forks back. They go back to the museum and get them off the R7.
That's brilliant.
But, he ended up, Neukirchner was the guy to watch in the first few laps of this race.
Uh-huh.
He just launched out of there and did real well. Took Haga a little while to catch him up, but Haga eventually put a very nice pass on him. But this whole race, too, like I was saying, there was battles just all over the place. You just saw so many good... I mean, that was a great race to be at, to watch, because, as you're watching the track, there's always some sort of on-track action, and you'd be, getting to see lead changes and stuff like that all along.
I was very impressed with Fabrizio. I was very impressed with Lacconi and Haslam finished fifth both races. You know, Neukirchner really faded in that second race. I think
he did.
He overdid it probably in the beginning and cooked his tires.
I think he cooked his tires. Yeah, exactly. And they were saying, you know, that he was trying to punch it out and open up a lead earlier on while his tires are fresh and all of that. And I think exactly that's what he did. He cooked the tires.
Yeah.
Another guy who impressed, I thought, in race two was Hopkins for the most part, although ended up fading.
He lost. Yeah, he faded like on the last two laps, but until that point, he was, I think, running in sixth at one point.
Yeah, he was really getting up there and everything. You know, basically his first race weekend out there, new bike, quite a bit of different things kind of going on for him and everything. It was an impressive performance, but yeah, just Sykes and Byrne kind of, you know, closed the door on him there in the last couple of laps and got past
Biagi
him.
Too, yeah. Yeah. All those guys. Yeah. Biagi's really stuffed himself in there.
Yeah.
Hey, old buddy.
Yeah. That's right. And Biagi was busy guy that whole race. He had a lot of things to demand his attention.
Oh, yeah.
It's good stuff. And then the big race to watch, like we were saying, was Fabrizio and Lecconi also battling for third. Yeah. Was real, real impressive. And Lecconi just
would not let him go. He would not let him go.
No, he would not let him go. And did he ever actually get past him?
No, he put a couple moves on
him. I don't think he did.
He put a couple moves on him. I mean, he was ahead of Fabrizio at one point. I mean, in the beginning. And Fabrizio caught him and passed him. But then Lecconi picked it up and started, kind of glued himself. But it just really shows that Valencia is a track where, you know, the satellite guys could definitely, I mean, that's a perfect example. I mean, it's pretty much the same. They're both the same bike, except you've got a factory machine and you've got a satellite machine. You know, in Australia, every time they hit the straight, Fabrizio would have been gaining, you know, a couple of bike lengths by the end of the straight. Here, that just doesn't happen.
It's just barely keeping ahead of him, kind of a thing. You know, the additional power of the factory bike is just not.
It's not very useful on this track,
basically. Right? Not very useful. There is a good way to put it. Yeah, yeah. But it was there, and it was enough to hold Lecconi at bay, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. And also I think Fabrizio's really starting to come of age. I mean, he was such a kind of thrashy rider for the last few years, and you know. He's not new to the world scene because he was in MotoGP also already.
Right.
I mean, considering that he's like, what, 24 years old, he's been around. But he's right. He's also, I think the Xerox team is just like really focused and they're getting excellent results and yeah.
Yeah, good stuff. I didn't realize Fabrizio was that young. He's only 24. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I knew he wasn't a, you know, ancient old guy, but yeah, I didn't realize he was that young. Because, I mean, speaking of ancient old guys, how old is Regis Lecconi?
He's like 33 or something like that, probably.
It's got to be at least that, because he had a MotoGP career. He's been around from factory rider and World Supers. I mean,
he did 250s and
one. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, he's been pretty much in every class that we ever watched.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
So. And, so yeah, he's been around for a while. Other good news here in race two, both BMWs finished. Corser picked up a point. Yeah. So Corser and Chaus finished 15th and 16th. Enough about World Superbikes, unless you got something else, Jules.
Well, the only other thing is that, you know, we're going to Assen next in Monza. And like I said a couple of shows ago, this is such a great three-race series because Valencia, Assen, and Monza are very different tracks. Assen's a very fast track, so it's gonna be really, really interesting to see how Spies does, you know, how Haga does hanging on to his lead. If anybody else comes up, I mean, I'm expecting that Aprilia is gonna want to do well in Monza, and it might be a good track for them because they do have a powerful little package. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. So, next race is the 26th of April, so.
A couple weeks away.
3 weeks. Yep. So be fun.
Indeed. So all right, moving on. What happened in the MotoGP world this past week that is worthy of note? Danny Pedrosa is confirmed for Qatar, unless that has changed again.
Yeah, which is funny because, you know, on Monday when I did the late show, he was still not confirmed.
Right.
So it turned around. I think he's basically very desperate to score some points in the first round, but I'm worried that he's going to, you know, I mean, if he falls and hurts that knee again, it's that just got operated on. Oof.
Yeah, it could be.
You know? But then again, you know, these guys take chances. It's amazing what the kind of injuries they ride with. So, you know, I mean, we've seen him do amazing stuff in Sepang in 2006 with a totally busted up leg as well. So,
right. On the other hand, we've seen him kind of bail at Laguna Seca in 2008.
Right. Right. You recall, so he'll show up. I mean, he may pull out. He'll show up for the race. It may also have to do something with the rules, the new rules that came out. There's a bunch of revisions that came out today.
Are there rules along those lines, though, that they have to be there for the season opener and stuff?
Well, basically, there's a rule that says that the team has to provide a substitute rider.
Mm.
Unless the main rider, something happens to them, like by the end of the first practice or before qualifying for the MotoGP class. So if they're so maybe they just don't have somebody, you know, to give the bike to, and they're saying, okay, well, you know what, the best thing we can do is just hope for some points from Danny Pedrosa.
Get your ass out there and ride. And those kind of rule changes and stuff, that's Dorna sweating the small grid.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, they, you know, you've got 18 riders on the entry lists, and as soon as you start having some injuries and stuff like that, you know, next thing you know, you're going to have, I don't know, easy to imagine, you know, 15 guys out there.
Yeah, I have one thing to say to Dorna about that, this particular rule. It's like, Dorna, safety, my ass. Like, you know, 800 cc's for safety, my ass. I mean, this is bullshit. It's like, I'm never gonna buy that argument again. I never did it in the first place, but I'm really not going to do it this time. You know, it's BS. And
tell us how you really feel, Jules.
No, I mean, this press release, which is basically an addendum of rules, it's big. It's big. It's getting detailed. It's starting to sound like a Formula One rule book, and it's starting to get worrisome. I mean, they did. We had questions. Remember when they were talking about when they had the first set of rules that came out, and it was like no pneumatic or other or hydraulically assisted launch systems. But you know, that was it. Well, they've really clarified it now. Basically, it's like all hydraulic controls have to be manipulated directly by the rider. And they even go so far as to saying that engine oil can only be used for cooling. Let's see. I want to get the exact wording here. So they say the use of engine lubricating oil for any purpose other than lubricating and cooling, such as powered hydraulic systems, is not allowed. So, you know, so you can't like route the stuff, because, you know, I mean, launch control in hydraulic launch controls basically means that the computer is assisting. You just let the clutch out and the computer actually does the hydraulic clutch work,
right?
You know, so now they're saying specifically that all hydraulic systems on the motorcycle must be powered only by the rider's manual inputs. That's directly quoted from their new rule. And the other really interesting rule that came out in this thing is that you know, they've got this five engines after we go to Brno, they only get five more engines for the next seven races.
Right.
Not quite so. You can
actually, what do they clarify it?
If basically, so this one's probably going to be like an interesting one to see how it gets played with. But if a competitor requires, so it says here, should a competitor for any reason, mechanical failure, crash, major damage, etc., require the use of another engine above their allocation, the technical director must be informed, blah, blah, blah. The rider will have 10 points deducted from his championship total when the engine is fitted. When the engine is added to allocation, even if it's not, doesn't end up getting used. So,
oh wow,
that's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, we knew that they had to have some sort of penalty for these. You know, when they come up with these, you know, you can only have five engines for these eight races, sort of rules, right? We knew that there has to be some penalty going on, and I guess 10 points is a lot.
Yeah.
But in some ways, hand,
imagine somebody like Valentino Rossi pulling a 20-30 point advantage and then saying, "Well, you know, Stoner had to detune his engine because he can't afford to lose his 10 points. I'm going to wreck my engine at every race." You know, I mean, there's some
you could strategize with that. Yeah, exactly. Whereas the Formula One take on this is to penalize the guys with grid positions when they. Because there's a little easier. The engine has to last two races. If it doesn't last two races, they get penalized 10 grid spots.
Right.
And they also get penalized, I think it's like 5 grid spots if they change the tranny. It's stupid.
Yeah, and, this is getting pretty
it
wild.
It is. It's getting insane. You know, set of tires has to last three races. You know,
right.
I mean, and the thing is they say these are cost-cutting measures. And on the surface, it might seem like that because, oh, you're building fewer engines. Yeah, but the factories are going to spend money to make an engine that lasts longer. And like the satellite teams this year for Honda got the pneumatic valve engine, but they're detuned. So they're only revving to a little over 18,000 RPM, whereas the factory is revving at 19. And the whole reason for the pneumatically valved engine was that you can get higher revs.
Right, exactly.
So they're basically giving these guys an engine that's probably heavier and more complicated, but doesn't rev any higher than the old style engine, you know, and it's just
It's getting wacky. Insane. It's getting very wacky, and you know, you'll probably already mentioned this like in the intro, but we were we were talking to Grace and Todd on Sunday on Formula One blog, and I didn't even hear about this tire rule that they have over there with you know if you do use two different compounds during a weekend, they have to be like really spread out. Like one has to be really soft, one has to be like significantly harder.
It's that's insanely stupid. And the thing is the drivers don't get a choice of compounds and stuff. Bridgestone brings what they bring. They bring the option and the prime. Here's your tires, and you have to use like at least one set of each one or whatever. This is in Formula One we're talking about. So, you know, like they have all these stripes painted on these tires and stuff. Like the full wets have a green stripe, and the intermediates that look a lot like the full wets, but they're not quite as deep as Sipe, those don't have a green stripe. And the option, I think, has a white stripe, and the prime has – it's freaking stupid.
Yeah,
and at least in MotoGP, as far as I know, the riders still have a choice of compounds, right? Bridgestone brings what they bring.
Mm-hmm.
The riders say – I want to use these tires, which they have to make that decision fairly early in the whole event.
Do I want to use the Stoner tire or the Rossi tire?
Yeah, exactly. but you know, at least they get an option, and because there are no pit stops and all that in Formula One or in MotoGP, you know, here's your race tire. This is the one you're going to use. And, you know, so they make that decision and they go out there. But yeah, if you start saying that, no, you have to bring the bowling ball hard tire and the, you know, super soft pink pearl eraser tire. It's like, well, I want the one that's in between. Well, sorry, we didn't bring that. You know, it's like, geez, just insane.
Pretty wild.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I see MotoGP and Dorna and even the MSMA coming along with more of these silly rules for various reasons. A lot of politics going on, like you just said in your little safety rant.
I think it's more than just that. I think it's because the rules, it's like the legal system, you know, you have to explain a rule because somebody finds a way around it. And so you make another rule. You never actually consider if you think outside the box, the best thing to do is to remove some of these rules.
Right.
But we never do. We always just keep adding them.
The thing is, like with the engine thing, and Randy Mamola had an article in Road Racer X magazine, just this issue I just got yesterday, talking about some of the changes in MotoGP rules. And he mentioned that five engines for eight races rule, which I'm still a little unclear on how does that work with the second bike, right?
Well, you can switch the engines between bikes. The engines are allocated to riders, not to motorcycles.
Yeah, that's not going to work in morning practice. You know, somebody dumps their bike and they want to run back and get the other one. They're not going to do an engine change out.
Rule, I guess. You know.
Yeah. So you know that's stupid. And the thing is, as Momola's point was, is why don't we just limit the revs? you can tell how fast these engines are revving. They have, you know, just, you don't even have to have telemetry and all of that from the engine. You can, they put microphones by the edge of the track, right, and they can get a very, very good idea of how high these engines are revving, you know, based on the sound. And so if you just say, limit our revs to 15,000 was the number Mamola used, but whatever number you pick, you know, there you go. You've extended the life of that engine significantly without doing any more work on it, because that is what causes engines to have to be rebuilt every right. single race, is that they're, you know, come on, they're asking a lot of these engines to rev over 20 grand.
Yeah, and then you're right. And then the only way to get around that in the current set of rules is to spend more money.
So, exactly. So, so you know, the whole soul saving money thing is stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So safety's out the window, saving money is out the window, and all we're getting is more and more rules.
Right. Right. And it's, and that's always been one of the wonderful things about MotoGP, is the slim and skinny rule book, you know?
Yeah, which is not so skinny anymore, but
no, exactly. You know. It's getting more and more complicated and more confusing and all of that. Have you read some of the metallurgy rules? Those are awesome.
Yeah, those were around for a while, haven't they?
They have been. They've been around for a long time, but I'm I'm looking at them and I'm like, oh my God, what does this mean?
Yeah, that stuff is cool. This stuff is cool.
It is. It's kind of slick because it shows you the level of like, you know, Uber development that we're talking about here,
and the amount of cheating that's been going on, or whatever.
Oh yeah, that too. You know, but it is a little confusing unless you happen to know what you're talking about with this stuff.
So I'll send you the link to the press release, because I think it's very interesting for anybody who's following the whole rules fiasco to read the new press release, because there's a lot of clarification to things that, you know, like how the engines are actually marked and what parts of the engine are actually considered part of the engine. And one thing that was yet another thing that's interesting is that the exhaust ports are sealed between races to make sure that the engine doesn't go back to the factory and, you know, gets run and tested or whatever. Like the engines are actually, if they're used, they get locked down. They get between weekends.
Interesting. Do they, how do they do that? I mean, that's kind of a, you know, because normally when you talk a seal, it's that little, you know, like a wire with a lead crimp.
Right.
Are you going to do that on an exhaust port? I mean, what, do they have to have like little safety wire hole on the exhaust port? You know, I don't think that's going to be happening. So that's interesting. And those are the sort of things where you make this rule and then you say, well, we'll just put a seal on it and stuff. And then somebody sort of says, well, how are you going to do that? You know, how are you going to make this so that somebody can't just simply, you know, bend the wire out of the way or whatever, right?
Yeah, well, and I mean,
somebody has to figure it out.
I mean, they don't go into the details of that, but they do say that used engines will have security seals wired over the exhaust ports immediately after they are removed from the motorcycle.
Which almost sounds like, I as soon as you said that, I had this vision of this, you know, MotoGP engine just pretty much wrapped in that wire. Like a little hay bale.
Right.
It's like, now work on it. You know? It's like
a generator.
Yeah, a ball of string.
But they did define exactly what the engine is, which was really like bothering me, is because, you know, it's a transmission part of it, part of it, you know, and it's not, so.
Okay. So. Yeah, which with motorcycles is, you know, I mean, in a nutshell, what we tend to think of as the, you know, the engine includes the transmission and all sorts of other stuff, because it's all tends to be integrated in a motorcycle engine. So, yeah. It remains to be seen, because that rule apparently is also going to morph and change in 2010 to, you know, more restrictive.
Right.
And
right.
Yeah, engines lasting. Do you have the exact wording of what's happening on that in front of you off the top of your head? Or because I can't recall it. If it was something crazy like engines having to last two races every time or three races every time or something.
I don't know,
like
but it's, you know, one bike per rider and on top of that, the engine thing. So, you know, I think it's the end for Randy Mamola. Randy DePuniere.
Yeah, the one bike per rider. Yeah, what did Liam say in your call with him? With 37 crashes, 39 crashes, but right. Liam had lost count. Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah. The one bike per rider, I mean, you could say that that could conceivably save money, but how is that going to work in with Dorna's demands, desires, wishes to have a fairly full grid? you know, these guys, part of the whole thing of practice is that they find the limit, right? And sometimes you have to find the limit by crashing.
Yeah. Yeah. And, no, I mean, there may be, you know, there may be practice may become something very different. You know, it may be, you know, slowly approaching the envelope instead of like really pushing it. I mean, Jeremy Burgess used to really complain about a lot of the rules that were being put on the racing part of the weekend, but that weren't being applied to the practice, because, you know, riders would end up using different fuel loads and running the machine in ways that it just was never meant to run in a race distance, and crashing and hurting themselves much more severely during the practice sessions and qualifying than during the races. So in that sense, maybe things will get better because you're going to have more strategy to, like, kind of, you know, just don't crash the bike, you know? It's kind of like when we go out to the track days, like, it sucks to crash.
Don't crash, right?
You know, you're done for the day.
Or the guy with a wild card ride that gets to come in, you know, and your instructions are pretty much don't crash.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Yeah. Finish the race.
And then you're still going to have some crazy, you know, mofo who's going to just go out there and tear it up because they have nothing to lose. So the safety thing is still kind of iffy, but yeah, I don't know.
You might be right on that one.
That rule has a tinge of class to it, you know? Like, it's a weird rule to have the one bike per rider, because we're so used to them being able to, like, say, oh, okay, this one's crashed. We'll start working. We'll start fixing it while the other one gets.
It takes the other one out on the track.
Yeah, but I want to know I really want to see a clarification of the flag to flag rule, because what, are they going to be swapping tires really fast? I guess, you know,
they're pretty much going to have to, or go back to the old method.
We haven't had a clarification of that yet, so
yeah. I would think that going back to the old method is the only way you're going to be able to do that significantly.
Yeah.
And I mean, come on, you can't expect these teams to also train to do really, really fast pit stops with tire changes and all of that, because then again, now you're introducing, they're going to have to spend more money on the motorcycles to make it so that they can do a quick change.
Right. Well, what I meant by like that it has a little bit of class to it is like it kind of brings back the original spirit of the sport, which is, you know, a guy shows up with a motorcycle and races around the track.
Right. Puts some tape on the headlights and yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So yeah. That aspect is appealing, and there's a bunch of stuff like the, you know, the loss of qualifying tires is kind of appealing. I'm even getting, you know, into the single tire thing. It's like I wanted the battle to continue between Michelin and Bridgestone and Dunlop, but you know, I'm over it, kind of.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm trying to be optimistic about it myself. I kind of want to see, especially Liam's call that you did with him was insightful, interesting, you know, bringing back, you know, the talk that Ducati was thinking, well, we'll go back to Michelin's. And
right.
And I was thinking, and one thing you guys didn't mention is that possibly sometimes the advantage is just having something different.
Oh, you know, no, I mean, that was the whole thing. I mean, we talked about this last year, like, you know, I mean, Livia Sipil came right out and said it, you know, back in 2004, we went to Bridgestone because that's the only way we thought we could beat Valentino Rossi.
Right. Right. And it might not be that the Bridgestone is better at every track. You know that. We had the Michelin track with the Bridgestone tracks.
Yeah.
It's just different.
It's just, yeah. They got the control. They got to be the number one team supplied by the tire supplier, which is a very big deal, because they get to kind of decide the direction of the development. And they did. I mean, you know, they really did.
Yeah.
You know, and then when that got taken away from them, they really were talking about going back to Michelin's,
right?
And and remember that when the tire, they were actually being rumored to like save the sport from a single tire rule in the last minute, because they needed, I think we needed what, six bikes to have a tire brand.
If I recall, yeah,
or
I think that was
Michelin's. Like,
Michelin's requirement was that they weren't going to come out unless there was, you know, enough demand.
Yeah.
Basically,
so it was like Tactois was like a given, if it, right, and then all of a sudden four Ducatis, and that would have been enough.
Yeah, but
whatever. Yeah. So anyway,
old news, water under the bridge.
Yep.
You know, it didn't happen. Like you say, though, I've kind of wrapped my mind around the whole single tire thing, and it's like, you know, okay, well, let's see how it pans out, basically.
Yep. Yep. And it's, you know, a few more days away, so.
I know. It's exciting. Which, again, want to mention it one more time because we screwed up and said that the Qatar race is on Saturday. It is not. It is on Sunday, which is better than
night. Because it's at night, it's actually like us on the West Coast get to watch it at like 1 p.m. Like, what a perfect time.
Right. Now, are you sure that they've got the whole daylight savings time and all that business correct? That it is 1 p.m. daylight savings time, Pacific time? Yeah, there you go. But if we, let's see, spring forward, fall back, I'm not 100% sure. You might want to double check at noon because it's GMT plus 3 in Qatar, and it's running at 11 o'clock at night, 2300 GMT
plus
3.
I'm pretty sure Qatar doesn't have, you know, daylight savings time.
I think they do, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, actually, you would know. You were out there.
Well, we went on an even weirder time.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, true. We went on British summertime.
Okay.
And it was bizarre. So we were an hour off from the actual Iraqi population.
Wow.
But in any case, it is running at, in Qatar, the race will happen at 11 p.m. at night, GMT plus 3. Double check your, go to whatever website you want that figures out your times and stuff for you to make sure if
time
you're going to watch it live on MotoGP.com.
Time.com.
Yes, there you go, time.com. And it's being shown on speed at...
Oh, sorry, it's called timeanddate.com. I'm sorry about that. Oh, my God. The website changed so much. I was like going there right now. Sorry.
I thought it was, I always used worldtime.com was the one that I checked out, but whatever it is, there's a bunch of those websites. And it's being shown on speed at 7 p.m. Pacific time, which is 10 p.m. Eastern time. Speed will run that race. So, you know, they're delaying it. What is that? Six hours. You know, it could be worse.
Yep.
So,
well, we'll be watching live on MotoGP.com.
Yeah, exactly. Unless I'm out, like if it's a sunny, beautiful day and everything, I might be out riding, but we'll see. I'm going to try to watch that one live. And the one thing I liked about Qatar last year was
the colors,
yes, everything was so striking and beautiful. The photos for of that race were fantastic.
Yep. Yep. Anybody out in Bay Area, we're going to be doing the Easter Sunday morning ride on Sunday also, so to Mount Tam. Bright and early.
Yeah, when are you guys starting and what are you doing and all that? We have a lot of listeners down there. They might want to join you if they hear the podcast in time.
Well, I think we have to meet at the station at 5 a.m.
Oh, God.
So, yeah.
What station?
Oh, I don't know. Go to Facebook or someplace else and just search for this Sunday Easter ride and Mount Tam and figure it out yourself. Sorry.
There you go. No problem. Nothing like good planning there, Jules. You're going to meet somebody at 5 a.m., but you're not sure
I'm
where.
I'm just going to meet some people out near where I live and follow them. So, you know.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So while we've been talking, and you put me on the spot there, I did check out time and date, and it is at 1 p.m.
Okay, good. So we figured that one out.
On the East Coast, right? So on the West Coast, on the East Coast.
West Coast, right. So, yeah, so that's 4 p.m. East Coast time, 3 p.m. Central, et cetera, et cetera. You can figure it out from there. But it's happening Sunday afternoon is live. So MotoGP.com. And if you haven't bought the subscription at MotoGP.com, you know, this one came up a little while ago on an email. We had a listener and unfortunately I don't have the email right in front of me. So I can't remember her name, but she asked us about buying the MotoGP.com package. I bought it again this year. It works out now. The translation from me from euros into dollars was $60. If you're not a 2008 customer, it's more. You get a discount for being a 2008 customer. But it's worth it to me just to be able to go in there and have, you know, relatively unrestricted access to all of the videos and results and interviews and all of the content that MotoGP.com has, because it is significant. There's a lot of stuff. I did not go with the high res. I just went with their standard res package.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. The high res is quite a premium. It's a fair amount of money more. And I didn't, it's half the time, even with the bandwidth that I have at home and everything, it's kind of jerky and choppy anyway. So it's a little bit like, you know, I'm just going to go with the other one because it's still pretty good. And it's always widescreen, you know, 16:9 aspect ratio. Looks great. If that's how you want to watch your races and stuff, it works fine. So I do. You know, MotoGP, that's one thing that we have as MotoGP fans that is actually pretty slick. Because, like, for instance, Formula One doesn't even have a similar worldwide package that you can purchase. The World Rally one is stupid expensive. The last time I checked into it last year, it was much more money than the MotoGP.com one. And World Supers is weird here in the States because even if you pay for it, you don't get to watch it until later.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Which is just stupid. Yeah. So with MotoGP.com, we have it's probably about the best situation of how it can be. You know, you pay your money and you get a chance to watch the races live. You get the live timing, I think, is free whether or not you bought a package, but, you know, that's kind of cool. There's always the gap between live timing and the telecast is a bummer, but other than that.
So before we go, let's do a very quick preview.
Yes, let's. We should. Rather than rambling on and giving MotoGP.com free plugs, let's talk about some racing stuff.
Okay.
All right.
So we've got we'll just go by their numbers. So Danny Pedrosa is number 3.
Mm-hmm.
Danny Pedrosa is number 3. We already talked about him. He's hurt. He's not going to be 100%. If he actually races on race day, because I have a feeling he may show up and do a Laguna Seca type of thing. And I'm not putting the guy down. I'm just saying he's I think he's hurt enough that we're. If he, you know, it might be better just to give up than to race for 2 or 3 points and risk injury. I don't see him doing very well. Although he is pretty good at this track, so I think that's probably the reason why he's coming. Aside from the grid issue, which I think does play a part. Andrea Dovizioso, during the Formula One blog call, I kind of dissed him, saying that he might actually be outshone by Tony Elias this year. I have kind of a mixed feeling about Dovizioso because he's always been on inferior machinery doing really well, and I think when he's going to be on the best bike, he might actually not have that extra drive that was pulling him to make that, you know, second rate bike race, you know, so well in the previous years. I think he's going to do very well at in Qatar.
Yeah.
Because he did well there last year, but also during testing that was one of his better tests.
Okay, and we should mention that both those guys are factory Repsol Honda teammates.
Yeah, that's the Repsol team, 3-4.
Yeah. Number 3 and 4.
Then we got the monster Yamaha Tech 3, number 5, Colin Edwards. He could be third. He could be 16th. I don't know. I mean,
it's hard to say with Colin. It really is. I mean, the guy's a super, super good rider and everything, but he's a little bit of a dark horse.
Especially at this track.
Yeah, exactly.
If you say France, I'll say podium. But if you say Qatar, yeah. Could be anywhere.
Yeah. France, Assen. Donington, Laguna Seca, and everything, you can expect him to shine. But Qatar, yeah, not so much.
Yeah,
and he's that's this the sort of main Yamaha satellite team, you know. But Tech 3, although Tech 3 is on quite a bit of a budget, they do get a fair amount of support from Yamaha, the factory. Are they still? Have you heard anything? If Colin Edwards, like we heard last year, where the factory was in effect, I think they were paying his salary. Do you know anything along those lines this year?
I don't, because I think it was split between the factory and Michelin. And now there's no more Michelin, so.
Right. Oh, yeah. And Colin was always such a big Michelin guy. That's true. So, yeah, Colin might have to take a pay cut this year. Wow. Interesting. Okay. Moving on. Number 7, Chris Vermeulen, riding for Rizla Suzuki, the factory Suzuki team. Rizla did come back, even though earlier on, a few weeks ago and everything, we thought they weren't gonna.
Which is good because we want to keep the sponsors, you know, interested in the sport.
You do. You have to.
Suzuki's doing really well. I mean, they always do well in the beginning of it, during testing, and we get all excited, and then they flop. But this year, I think they're really, it's starting to pay off, and I could see Vermeulen top 5 in Qatar.
Yeah, I wouldn't be too surprised with that. And overall expectations for the season and everything, I think for both Vermeulen and Caparossi, certainly wouldn't be surprised to see both of them on the podium at some time or another. And, you know, possibly race wins. Like we said, you know, if it rains, you can count on Chris.
So. Well, it's Qatar. It's unlikely.
It's not. Yeah, but it might be damp. Yeah. It was damp last time. All right. Let's see. Moving on. We got all the way down to number 14, Randy Depunier, one of our favorites here on the show, riding LCR Honda.
In the dirt.
In the dirt. Yeah, exactly.
That'll be my pick for the tipping competition.
Wow. Yep.
Sorry, Randy.
Randy goes through a lot of motorcycles. So, are they going to be running their Playboy colors at Qatar?
You know, I don't know.
I doubt it in Qatar.
You're right. Not in Qatar.
But okay. I don't know for sure. I haven't seen
that. No, it's Europe, and it's only for 2 races, I think. So Italy and Italy. So
Okay. So they won't have like the bunny out there with a barcode that says Playboy.
Nice.
The bunny made out of like barcode or dots or smoke. Something sort of occluded. Yeah. We've had a lot of email traffic about the Randy Depunier Playboy sponsorship. It's kind of a running joke. So, all right, number 15 is on the Gresini. The San Carlo Honda Gresini is Alex DeAngelis. And you sort of thought that we'd see the... Well, Alex is going to be an interesting player this year as well.
Well, he is, and he's done some... He's had some good races and some really crappy races, but he's definitely going to be outshone by Elias. I think that the whole team is really moving towards Elias for this season because they're going to have the factory bike. It's very important to note that Tony Elias is going to be riding a factory Honda, not a satellite machine. So that means the whole team is kind of shifting. So even, you know, even though that he is part of the team, I think the support's not going to be there. So it's going to have to be all him. And that's actually a situation he's not that unfamiliar with, because that's the way he was in the 250s for quite a few seasons. And I don't know, maybe he could be a dark horse, but I don't think it's going to be a Qatar.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm thinking, you know, below 10th, like 10th, 11th, 12th, maybe something like that.
Okay. And next up,
Tony Elias. We got number 24. And I mean, not yet. Not yet. I think he may finish in the top 10 later on in the season. I think there's gonna be, we're gonna go to Jerez, and I think we're gonna see some good stuff from him. And yeah, I see, and Estoril, obviously, you know, he loves that track. So, but not Qatar.
Now, Elias has had a bit of a reputation as kind of the wild guy, and when we talked about like Haga having different lines. Tony Elias has different lines as well.
Oh yeah,
and it tends to mess up some of the other riders occasionally.
Oh yeah, we have a lot of evidence of riders being very vocal about it.
Right,
you know, from guys like Rossi and Colin Edwards too.
Exactly, guys that normally don't, you know, play that card.
Right,
you know, it's not like Rossi's the guy that comes out and says, you know, hey, so and so was, you know, crazy.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that one was, I'm kind of interested to see if that continues.
Yep. Yep. Then we got that crazy Australian, Casey Stoner, number 27.
Right. And I'm looking at the MotoGP.com website, and they've got the pictures. Uh-huh. Is that about the scariest picture you've ever seen?
I'm not looking at it. What is it?
Oh, well, he's wearing looks like a green camouflage hat of some kind. I can't tell what's on the hat, and a Ducati jacket, and he looks about pretty mad, and it's not a very good picture.
He likes to hunt, so maybe it's a hunting cap.
It's some kind of hunting cap, but he's also, you know, it's not quite a mad look. It's more of a sulking look. And, you know, I'm not sure what's going on here with Casey Stoner, but this picture they should not have chosen as the one for him to be, you know, this is Casey Stoner, number 27, riding for the factory Ducati Marlboro team, who are still sponsored by Marlboro. And our one last cigarette company sponsorship going on that seems to be pretty strong.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, so, you know. If the scaphoid holds, I think he could win this one.
Yeah, he's done well at Qatar in the past. It's a tough one.
It's going to be a huge test.
It is. It really is because of the whole, like you were saying. There might be so much sandbagging going on with the testing that we just had at Jerez, and yep. Not going out
all off season has been like that.
Exactly,
he has not completed more than five laps or six laps at a roll. And five, you know, I mean, if he's out for seven laps, only five are the fast ones. So, you know,
right. So, what is that going to translate to as far as a race?
Yeah, and we won't know until the race because it's going to be the same thing through practice and qualifying too. You'll see.
Right, I think you're right, and I think a large portion of it is sandbagging. But I also wonder if a significant amount of it is also possibly taking it easy. You know what I mean?
Sure.
A kind of a combination of both.
Yeah.
Because every day is going to count on that injury.
Oh, yeah.
And, So...
No, there was actually a great email from William Hall. He said this back in December. We never actually mentioned it on the show. We should have mentioned this. He knows a lot about these injuries. And because he works in orthopedics, and he was talking about like how a lot of people that have this injury, if it doesn't heal quickly enough, if you can't get the bone graft, for example, to take, or if it comes apart later, they end up having their whole wrist fused because that's the only way that they can keep from the pain and keep the thing together. So that's pretty nasty.
Yeah, and it's going to make riding a motorcycle extremely difficult.
Oh my god.
So, yeah, and you know, hopefully it doesn't come to that. I think we did mention that email, but in any case, I remember that one. It was excellent. It was because he knew what he was talking about as far as that stuff, and it kind of taught us a lot because it's a small bone in your wrist, and it's just one of those things that it's not getting enough blood supply to heal, to knit correctly and quickly enough, and especially with the time schedule that these guys have.
Right.
It could be bad news.
Let's hope not.
Hope not.
Okay. Casey Stoner's old teammate, Marco Melandri, with Hayate. I think he'll finish in the points.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
That's
an interesting prediction there.
Uh-huh.
Good. Yeah. I mean, granted, you know, points go all the way down to 15. You only have 18 guys on the grid, so... I guess you're not exactly going out on a limb, but
no. Well, you know, it's
it's interesting. It, you know, last year it could have been pretty safe to say that Melanchi would not finish in the points,
right?
So, and what exactly is Hayate? Do you know?
I don't know.
Yeah, I haven't heard either. But whatever, they're running a Kawasaki out there, so
the Dornasaki.
Yes, the Dornasaki exactly. So, I hope Melanchi does reasonably well overall this season. You know, you're not going to see – he's not winning the championship.
No,
he's not going to finish top
actually,
five.
I really think that it's going to be downhill after the summer break for him. So this is – because the first half of the season is the only chance he has to really shine. So he's going to really be putting it down.
Yeah.
And he's been doing pretty well in testing. He was pretty mid-pack. I mean, he was beating a lot of the Hondas. So we'll see.
Interesting stuff. Yeah. And it remains to be seen.
Good luck, Ducatis, actually. Mika Kallio, number 36, Pramac Racing, which is basically the junior Ducati team now. I'm not expecting much from him first time out. Probably, you know, maybe in the points, but I think he's one of the guys that the Lions will beat.
Okay, interesting. Overall, for maybe not just for Qatar, but for like for the season and stuff, what do you think of Miko?
I don't know. I think that the Ducati GP9 is going to continue confounding riders other than Casey Stoner. And all those guys are going to be struggling a lot of the time. So no, I'm not expecting much from Mika Kallio. Sorry, buddy.
Sorry, Mika. Yeah. Season is done. But no, interesting. All right, and then number 46, Valentino Rossi.
Yeah, so you know he's done some crazy stuff in Qatar before, and last year he finished fifth. You know, he almost finished fourth, but that was first time out in Bridgestones. He's obviously raring to go. You know, if it wasn't for Stoner, it would be a shoo-in for him to win, I think. But I think that Stoner is going to win Qatar.
Is that your pick? Would you say?
I think that's going to be my pick, and if that means that Rossi will get a second and then go from there.
Interesting. Yeah, and I actually went the opposite way, which now I'm committed to stick with. unless I change it and don't tell anybody.
Right.
Yes. But, obviously Rossi's my favorite for the season as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting to watch and to see him, you know, what he can do out there.
I'm just so blown away by Stoner's, dominance. Now, it's not consistent enough to say that he's got, you know, all he has to do is keep from getting injured, re-injuring that wrist. Because he's kind of sporadic. Like usually he knocks out very, very, lap after lap pretty much the same times. And now it's like he hits a hot lap and then he has a couple slow ones. So there's some sandbagging going on for both these guys. I think that Rossi's also not going all out.
Rossi has always been a huge sandbagger.
Yeah.
You know, he's. And so, yeah, you can't, testing is testing, which is just, I think Rossi had a story just not long ago where he said, well, testing doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't. But the championship is between those two guys. I think, though, that as far as the whole championship is concerned, you know, let's talk long-term predictions here, you know, removing horrific injuries off the table and everything, that Rossi has shown what he can do. Rossi has possibly learned, you know, maybe he's had a slight de-arrogancing thing, attitude adjustment, whatever you want to call it. And he knows that, well, you know, Stoner doesn't, you know, it took a little while for Rossi to get inside Stoner's head, but I think Rossi now has Casey Stoner's number and can do it. And I think he can do it again this year. And I'm not sure that Casey Stoner has learned in the off season how to prevent that.
Yeah, yeah. But do you remember Valencia, Stoner dominated, so.
Mm-hmm. That's true. But you know. Somewhat the second half of the season was spotted with these incidents. And I think that Rossi can find the right card to play.
It's going to be a good championship. It's going to be the best one ever.
It's going to be the best season ever. Yeah. So.
All right. James Tozen, 52. I don't know if he doesn't get sabotaged by Colin, then like a cherry bomb in the exhaust or something.
Yeah.
I think he'll do pretty well. I think he'll finish in the top 10.
Do you think the whole crew chief thing is going to benefit Toslin overall? I mean, this has caused so much ugliness.
Enough about those guys. Unfortunately, I don't know that much about those particular guys. I know that Guy Coulson has been is no slouch, so I don't think Colin's getting that raw of a deal. I just don't know enough about those guys to think it's going to make that something gels against about those guys. So let them work together. We'll see.
Yeah, exactly. I'm kind of with you on that one. Same story. Don't, you know, you haven't, you don't get to read enough stories about these guys. They're the crew chiefs that we're talking about here tend to know, but it certainly pissed off Colin. And, yeah. I think Colin's coming out looking like
he's going to want to beat Toslin.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So, big time. Yeah. But so as far as Toslin is,
Colin's going to try to be in front.
Yeah.
If it's like,
yeah.
Even if it's over last place, you know?
Yeah. But I think as far as the way things look, I think that Colin is looking like the childish one in this one. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but it fits his personality.
Hey, you think so?
Yeah.
I suppose. But, yeah.
He doesn't hold all back. Right. He doesn't hold back ever. I mean, come on. Has he ever held back?
No, that's true. He is an OBS kind of guy, I've never really thought of him as one of those, as a whiner, basically. I mean, you know, he says what he needs to say and he can overcome. You know, even like his relationship with Michelin was always so strong. But last year he was, you know, so torqued at them that he came out and said, you know, these guys are stupid kind of a thing, you know, right. A couple of times. So I'm just a little surprised that he's taking this thing to such an extreme with the wall in the pit and all of that business. But whatever. Yeah,
good point. Good point. So, both those guys, I think, can be in the top 10. Colin is actually more, I can see Toslin as a more likely top 10 finisher because Colin is just so erratic at tracks like this. Right, Setajibba now, number 59. I think he's going to be, you know, I mean, he's won races here. A race. And this is also where his entire career collapsed because of Qatar. So, you know, this is where the curse was placed on him by Valentino Rossi. He never won a race after that incident back in 2005.
Right.
And I think it's going to continue. I really do.
I think
he's going to be out of the points.
So I was just going to say, though, my next question was, is the curse still in effect? You know, what's the shelf life date on the curse? And
he left, he came back, you know, he cut his hair. So I don't know. We'll see.
We'll see. We'll see. I think Rossi's moved on to greener pastures as far as who he's going to place his curse on.
Of course. Of course. Yes. But it's this. Rossi forgot about that curse a long time ago. It was Sete that was so obsessed with it.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
He's the type of guy who's going to go be out there on the grid saying, I've got to do well in this race. I've got to do well in this race. And to the point where he's going to, you know, do something stupid.
Yeah. I'm so looking forward
to seeing him on the race day. It's going to be amazing.
I think really so too. Great. I think I'm looking forward to it. And then, like I've said before, you have the Sete girlfriend shot. You know, every time Sete has some problem on the track, cue Sete's girlfriend standing in the pit looking shocked. Girlfriend of the week. So, all right, number 65, Lars Cafferassi.
Right. You know, again, Suzuki's been so strong. I could see him, you know, top seven maybe.
Yeah, I wouldn't be too surprised. I think he'll do well. Like we said, Suzuki has been, you know, preseason, you just can't tell. But Loris is such a talented guy. And even though I believe he's the oldest guy on the grid this year, right?
Yes, yep.
Yeah,
yep.
And, you know, barring that, I mean, he's got a lot of talent. He's got a lot of heart. He'll do all right.
Yeah.
Okay. Number 69, my personal sort of fanboy guy that I root for, Nicky Hayden, Casey Stoner's teammate, riding the Ducati. He's had mixed results in testing. He's out there doing the Nicky Hayden thing, being the hardest worker, putting in the most laps, the dedication, et cetera, et cetera. But some of the, you know, the numbers, the raw lap time numbers aren't all that much to scream about.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's going to be, you know, somewhere around 10th or 11th in this race.
I wouldn't be surprised to see that. Yeah.
By the way, Sete actually is older than Loris.
Is he?
Yeah, I just looked it up really quick.
He's holding his age pretty good. So, you know, and not in a gay way, I'm saying that. But
come on, Navy guys.
You know how it is. Yeah, we have our names on our pants. But They, I'm surprised about that. So back to Nikki.
I want to see him do well, especially sure. in the duck. But I don't think it's going to come this race.
I agree. I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I don't think it's going to come this season. So yeah. This is a building year. This is a building year for Hayden. And so we'll see how it works out.
He looks all good right. in those leathers, though.
yeah.
Red, white. I mean, it just suits him. It's, you know. Let's see. Yuki Takahashi, number 72. He's one of the few rookies. I mean, are we going to consider Sete a rookie?
I don't think so. Know? I don't think he is a rookie. He's not in charge. He's not in line for the Rookies so Cup or whatever it's called. You know, the Rookie of the Year award.
So we got Kallio, we got Takahashi and Kanepa.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think Yuki's really struggling. He's pretty much been at the back of the pack throughout testing, and there's been no real improvement. He's with a good team. But as Dovizioso showed last year, they were actually quite capable. But, you know, it's not actually the same people.
No.
So I see him as being one of the guys that Melandri gets to beat for a point or two.
I agree. And, somebody's got to be at the back of the grid.
Yep.
Might as well be Yuki. So he's got a pretty, decent career and everything so far.
I really like him. I really like his writing style, and I like his, tenacity and stuff. But, you know, I'm not impressed at all so far with him in MotoGP and in testing.
Right.
He's not sandbagging either, so.
He's anti-sandbagging? Yeah. What you're saying?
Oh, yeah.
So he's trying desperately to anti-sandbag.
Right. So Nicola Canepa, 88. He's been with the Ducati squad for a long time as a test rider. He's a really young right. guy.
But there's those shocking pictures. Years. And from Indy, where he was, he did very, very well in the test session in Indianapolis last year. And there was those photos of him just pushing that machine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and some impressive stuff. And I don't know,
I mean, aside from Stoner, I think he's probably the most capable Ducati rider, except for the fact that he hasn't been showing lately in the times. I actually think he's going to finish, pretty low on the maybe 12th, 13th, or something like that.
Now, why is that, do we think? I mean, because he is, like you say, he's ridden the Ducati before, and aside from Stoner, he's on paper, he's probably, one of the guys that's certainly most Ducati-like. He has come to grips with the bike. He can put in some fast lap times. We've seen that. So why is...
develop it in some ways. But the thing is that I think that there's just too many tracks that are just so going to be so wildly different from what he's used to. And going out to Mugello and I don't know if they test him in Mola or not, but probably Valencia they probably tested it with him, but yeah. Not in Qatar, not in Australia, So those kinds of rounds he's going to really struggle.
Okay.
So
that's fair. That's a good assumption. Yeah.
Jerez, all right. I don't think they tested in Jerez before this year. So
just before the official one? No, I don't think so. They saved that for the official one. Yeah. All right, and last but not least, number 99, Jorge Lorenzo.
Also
ran the Fiat Yamaha. Yeah.
And I think he's going to do extremely well. I could totally see him on the podium on this one.
I think so, too. He kicked butt
last year.
Yeah.
And, he really blew away pretty much all my expectations of him last year.
Last year, yeah. Yeah, and I think he's fit. I mean, he's pretty much recovered from all of his injuries, has he not? And he should be. I think he's going to be a guy to watch out there. That's for sure.
He's looking great in testing. He's just all around. He just looks very strong.
Right. So Yeah, other than his bizarre sort of comic that he's got going on, Lorenzo's Land, and all of that, I think he is going to be definitely a guy to watch.
Yep.
So, all right, there's our whole 18 riders that we've got for MotoGP, which is they managed to squeak together the 18, you know, by adding Sete and bringing back Marco and all of that. That it was looking pretty grim for a very, very small grid for MotoGP.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And hopefully we don't see some of the injuries and stuff that we've seen, well, like last year, for instance, because, you know, it is going to make for small grids.
Yeah.
You know, even with that rule, you know, rules notwithstanding and all of that about how you have to provide substitute riders and all this business, which talk about something that's not going to save the teams any money.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so basically it means that, you know, if somebody gets hurt and they can't go to the next round, you got to go shop for a rider.
Right, and pay him and pay to get him out there and take a chance on wrecking your million-dollar motorcycle and everything else. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I that's totally a Dorna, you know, got to have a nice grid rule.
Yep.
So, but all right. Enough bitterness about Dorna. There we go. Looking forward. And, of course, next week we'll talk about the Qatar wrap-up and see what happened and how far off we are or right on the money or whatever it is. So kind of looking forward to that.
I think we're going to be right on the money.
You think so, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. You did really well in the tipping competition last year. So maybe I'll have to follow your tips or something. But
there you go.
Right on. All right, well, why don't we call it a night? Run pretty long here, and we'll talk to you again next week, Jules.
Well, let's get excited. Oh. It's the season's about to start.
I'm super excited.
Without saying, you know, like, all right, here we go. You know, don't miss the race and you know.
All that kind of stuff. Yay. MotoGP.
I'm running out of juice so fast myself because, right boot camp, baby.
There you go. Yeah, you're doing your exercises and stuff. Get out there and get the blood pumping. Yeah, it's good for you.
All right.
All right, we'll talk to you again next week, Jules.
Ciao.
All right, I told you that was a long call, but I hope you enjoyed it. It was fun talking to Jules there after a week off. Appreciate that Jules did that show for me last week, which, by the way, because Jules' busy schedule and everything, that show came out a little late. I noticed the download numbers are always less when that happens. So that means that a lot of people are missing the show. You know, it's not up on the normal Friday, and then the following Friday comes, and they miss an episode and this and that. I encourage you, don't let that happen. That show, number 171 that Jules did, was awesome stuff. He had a call with Liam Schubert. It was really great to hear from Liam again. They did just a chit-chat session. It was good stuff. So make sure you listen to that one, episode number 171. Then I have one other email I want to cover here real quick. This is a podcast feedback type of email on the negative side. The subject is, warning, don't read this if you can't stand gobby nod ends telling you how to run your own show. So not exactly 100% sure what a nod end is, but I'm thinking it's not all that necessarily the best thing. But in any case, Chris G sent a bit of a wake-up call for me in some ways, and in some ways it's, well, let's talk about it. A couple excerpts from Chris's email. He says, a long-time listener slowly growing disillusioned with the lack of structure and enthusiasm you guys are exhibiting. Just seems like you've been giving it less than 100% for a year now, and it really comes across. I know you're busy and this is just a hobby, but why not entertain more contributors, et cetera, et cetera. If you don't have time, find someone who does and take a break. Also, how about focusing explicitly on MotoGP and not digressing into superbikes all the time right after we do a big long show about superbikes? He said, I know it's the off season, but really I don't care about superbikes. If I did, I'd get a superbike podcast. And several other suggestions that are good suggestions about stuff that we could do for the show, you know, making it more, limiting it to 40 minutes, having segments, things like that, you know, a bit more like a magazine show, a bit like the show used to be. And I'll tell you, you know, and I replied to Chris, I don't mind getting email like this. I like email like this. This is not, you know, some sort of insulting, you suck, something like that. You know, this is constructive criticism. And Chris has a point. I have been disengaging a little bit, and I've been telling you for several episodes about how busy I am. And I try not to digress too much into that because, you know, you don't want to hear me whine about how busy I am. But I do know that there's a lot of stuff going on, and I am somewhat disengaging from the show, and it is affecting the quality of the show. And basically all I can do is apologize for that. I still enjoy doing the calls with Jules. It's an excellent outlet for both of us, and I think they tend to come across, and we tend to get pretty positive email for it. So the show is constantly evolving just kind of the way it is. Because like Chris says, you know, this is a hobby. And when the hobby starts becoming a chore and a job and is taking, I don't know how many hours a week and this and that and the other, it was getting to be like work. So sort of fast tracking the production here a little bit. And yes, I know that sometimes I'm not as well prepared as I should be and stuff like that. And all I could say is I apologize. And then the hard side of me says, if you don't like the show, you don't have to listen to it. Which, you know, I hate to be that way, but it's somewhat how it is. but I'm going to try to focus again. Now that the season's starting, I think that it'll be a little bit easier, and we'll see what we can do about getting some stuff going on. Just like I say, it takes planning, like Chris says, you know, looking for contributors, looking for a variety of things. And those things, that's always a double-edged sword. Contributor sounds like a great idea, and I'd love it if people sent me stuff. And every now and then people have sent me stuff. But a lot of times when people send me stuff, it's more work because they send it in such a way that it needs a lot of editing, or that it has to be sort of integrated in or fiddled with or stuff like that. So that's not necessarily the easiest answer. So there's my mea culpa for the week, hopefully for the year. You're not going to hear that anymore, but that I do acknowledge that it is a fact. So, all right, next week's show, we're going to be just on top of the game, and we're going to be talking about Qatar, wrap-up of our first race of the season and how great it was and this and that and the other and all kinds of good stuff. So looking forward to that. And why don't we sign off for now, because it's been an incredibly long show, and we'll talk to you again next week, and keep the shiny side up and the rubber side down, and enjoy the nice weather if you're getting any out there. Oh, geez, got the tape in there backwards here. One more time. MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I'm solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.